Heidi.
I'm Brittany.
And this is Transforming Together, Hope Works Podcast. So this month, April, is Sexual Assault Awareness Month. And so this month, we're transforming the way we view sexual assault prevention by examining rape culture.
Mm-hmm. And if you've never heard of the term rape culture, it might sound a little bit like jargon. Rape culture refers to the landscape in which things like rape and sexual assault are allowed to thrive. There is a Baltimore-based survivor-led collective called Force. I really admire the work that they are doing. They use arts-based activism to produce large-scale public art projects. They really focus on taking up space and forcing folks into a really difficult conversation.
An awareness of rape culture.
Yeah. So their whole mission is to upset rape culture and promote a culture of consent. So they have this really lovely definition, which says that in a rape culture, people are surrounded by laws and language and everyday phenomena that validate and perpetuate rape, which then creates an environment where rape is a problem that seems like it can't be solved.
So the idea is it's kind of this insidious thing where even if you don't think you know someone who's a survivor of sexual assault, or even if you know, oh, I personally, I would never rape someone, we're still surrounded by this culture that's deeply learned and indoctrinated into how we behave and how we react to things and is in our media and is in our lives. And we want to look at an article today that really examines what rape culture is and breaks down the steps we need to take to end it as a frame for our discussion today. So we encourage you to look the article up online and read it in its entirety because we won't have time to go through all of it. And it also has lots of internal links that you can click on. It's called 10 Things to End Rape Culture, and it's from The Nation, and it can be found on their website. And the contributors to this article were Isha Pandit, Jacqueline Friedman, Nuala Cabral, and Jessica Valenti. And I love this article from the first sentence, which is, rape culture exists because we don't believe it does.
Mm-hmm. And I think just by switching the conversation away from sexual assault prevention and awareness and really focusing on rape culture, it allows us the opportunity to hold ourselves accountable. What makes rape culture so insidious is that we can be complicit in it without even realizing that we are complicit. And when we think about rape culture, we tend to think just about the explicit violence. So we think about rape. We might think about intimate partner violence, or we might think about the deaths that are related to those issues. But there's this really great pyramid that was put out by 11th Principle Consent. They're an organization. And they show this pyramid with normalization of violence as the foundation of a rape culture. So normalization looks like things like victim blaming or rape jokes, quote unquote, locker room talk or boys will be boys. And then on top of that, you have degradation, which are things like catcalling and street harassment, revenge porn or non-consensual photos. On top of that, you've got the removal of autonomy. So sexual coercion or lack of informed consent. All of these things allow the explicit violence to happen. And so this article in The Nation argues that the first thing that we can do is actually name the real problems.
And that it lists those as violent masculinity and victim blaming. But really, I think it's any of these things that are part of the pyramid from the foundation up that allow rape culture to exist and permeate where we live. Things like equating masculinity and expression of masculinity with violence inherently, and power and control as the equivalent of masculinity, when really power and control in relationships and interpersonal relationships is never a healthy thing and not something that has to be part of who men are and how they express themselves.
Yeah. And when we talk about victim blaming, this is something that we talk about a lot. That looks like friends or loved ones asking questions such as, you know, what were you wearing? Or how much did you have to drink?
Or were you alone?
Yeah. Did you sleep with this person before? Or asking questions related to someone's sexual history. All of those things make the responsibility that of the victims or the survivors, and it shifts the focus away from who should really be responsible, which is the person who is committing the act.
We teach people don't get raped. We don't teach people explicitly don't rape.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a huge problem and a huge contributing factor to why this culture that permits sexual assault to continue to occur is so prevalent.
Mm-hmm. And last week we mentioned the term respectability politics, and I didn't have an eloquent definition at the moment, and I don't why I overthought it. But really at its core, it's just this idea that someone needs to be respectable in order to deserve respect, or someone needs to be respectable in order to deserve basic rights and to be treated with humanity. And Heidi, you made this really great point about respectability politics as it relates to survivors.
Yes. So the idea of needing to be a perfect victim, mm-hmm. and the idea that, oh, if you were wearing a dress that covered up everything, and if you hadn't had anything to drink, if you fit the boxes of you didn't do anything, quote unquote, wrong
to invite to assault.
Right. If you definitely said no, if you definitely physically pushed away and kicked someone and were, you know, still, and the idea I think often is, you know, raped in a dark alleyway by a stranger, mm-hmm. then that's the only time when you deserve respect and safety and justice under the law and in your society and your community. But that's a load of crap, mm-hmm. right? Like, no one ever deserves or is asking to be raped or sexually mm-hmm. assaulted. And even if they do fit into those exact rules, that still doesn't guarantee justice. That still doesn't guarantee that society won't be jumping down their throats.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then you mentioned that even if you do all of those things right, even if you have someone with you on your way back to your car, or if you carry your keys in your hand as a weapon, or you watch what you drink, what that's really saying is, rape the next girl. Don't rape me because I'm prepared, but rape the next girl.
And that's such a mess, too, because I want every single girl, even someone who is more drunk than me or who's more alone or who's in a bad part of town, I want her to be
bad.
Safe. Right. Can get into that as well. I want her to be just as safe and have just as much right to her bodily autonomy as I do. Mm-hmm. And it also, I think, feeds into stereotypes of who we think of as rapists and how we think about sexual assault.
Yes.
We're taught this idea of the dark, evil stranger in an alleyway. But the majority, I don't have the stat in front of me, but the majority of sexual assaults and rapes, the rapist is someone the person knows, mm-hmm. whether they're in their family, a friend, a partner, an ex, or just even someone you meet at a party. It's mm-hmm. it's usually not a stranger. And by only thinking about people who commit rape as these dark villains, often that's racialized as mm-hmm. well, it prohibits us from holding people accountable mm-hmm. who are our friends or our neighbors or people we know who are still capable of and do perpetrate sexual violence.
Yeah. And like, that's the thing. That's what adds to the silence around rape. Because if it's someone that I at one point trusted, or if it's someone that I considered my friend, if it's someone that I'm in a relationship with, I think a huge amount of time afterward is spent processing, like, did that really just happen? I thought I knew this person, or I thought this person cared about me. And we really have to shift that idea away from stranger danger and be able to look at people who exist in our world either as a friend or a family member and say, no, what you did is rape. And how do we hold you accountable to this while honoring the experience of the person who experienced the rape or the assault? We can't just say, well, you know, they're going to go to college and this might mess up their career. Or we can't tell someone that the experience or feelings of their rapist is more important than their own experience.
One of the things we talk about a lot around Sexual Assault Awareness Month is the utmost importance of believing mm-hmm. survivors, because yeah. so much of the culture, the media, the court system is designed to not believe or to undermine or to victim blame. Mm-hmm. And that can often be really easily internalized into yeah. self-blame. Yeah. But to listen and to believe. And people will throw out stats about false rape claims, but really that's infinitesimal mm-hmm. compared to the number of rapes that do occur that are unreported and for which there's no sense of justice or accountability.
And what happens when we shift this conversation is we also need to change the way that we talk about masculinity. And you mentioned this just a moment ago, Heidi. Are we giving men and boys the credit of being whole human beings who experience a full range of emotions. You know, I think when we say that boys will be boys or that's just the way it is, we're actually really limiting boys and men, and we're putting them into a box, and we're saying that your masculinity is tied in with your ability to be violent or tied in with your aggression. And I just refuse to accept that one-dimensional idea of who boys and men can be and who they are.
Right. That idea of boys will be boys kind of extends out to men are entirely about their sex drive. Mm-hmm. And you can't expect them to control themselves. So women have to behave a certain way so as not to invite that natural, impulsive, raging sex drive. Mm-hmm. And that's not fair to men either. I think they are able to have control. But if they're in this rape culture that empowers that idea about them, it's harder to find examples of healthy masculinity and how you can behave instead.
And that also works against men who are survivors of rape themselves. Then there's this whole added layer of social stigma that men can't be raped or men want it all of the time. So then we see men who are affected by sexual assault who are then afraid to come forward because they don't want to face the stigma. And so it's really a double-edged sword, and we really have to think about what does healthy masculinity look like. I certainly know that there are wonderful men out there who don't believe in entitlement to other folks' bodies, and we need to lift up those stories.
So part of that ties into the next point we wanted to talk about, which was media literacy. When we're looking for examples of what toxic masculinity can look like and how we can look for examples of healthy masculinity. And also looking at media, so much of the media that we see and consume does in its own ways perpetuate rape culture and promote sexual violence or addresses it on the show without being victim-centered or without really talking about these issues in a complex way. So we really need to think about being critical when we're examining media and also demanding a higher standard. Mm-hmm. You know, what we watch will then reflect upon what more media we get, what type of media is created. And so really advocating for and consuming the media that does have alternative presentations and representations mm-hmm. of consent and of what it means to be a survivor and what it means to have healthy and diverse expressions of gender.
Yes, because that's such a huge aspect of the media's power, is that essentializes masculinity to aggression. It essentializes masculinity to being physical or being powerful or being strong. And then on the flip side, essentializes femininity as being passive, as being weak, as needing to be saved. So we have to really challenge those polarized ideas of what it means to be a man and a woman, and then really just destroy the gender binary, which suggests that those are the only two genders that exist. And then the other ways that the media is complicit and active in supporting rape culture is through just the outward objectification and sexualization of bodies. You know, whether it's music or movies or television, you see so much of, let me give this woman alcohol to make her more pliable and more likely to have sex with me. You know, we really encourage date rape. Whether it's Blurred Lines.
I hate that song. I hate it. I hate it so much.
Yeah.
It's the idea. I know you want it. I know what you want, and I'm going to give it to you. Whether you're actually saying you want it or not, you know, the way that you know if someone wants it, if they tell you, if they ask for it.
Yeah.
And It seems like a little, like people, oh, that's why are you complaining about something so small? But it's not, because it does feed into this whole rape culture. And frequently people will try to divert. If you're talking about issues like sexual assault in the media or in songs, they'll say, why are you focusing on this issue when there are women with actual problems in Afghanistan or in Sudan or fill in the blank?
Yeah.
And that's super messed up too.
Because just like we don't want to essentialize gender, we don't want to essentialize violence to any one culture or community or country or religion. There's this idea that the grass is always greener and a refrain that's going around a lot right now is actually your grass is green if you water it. And so rather than focus on what's happening in someone else's backyard, we really need to be concerned with what's happening in our own yard.
Right. So that's a tactic to kind of divert from the actual problems that are happening here. And it also undermines the activism and the work of the women in those countries who are working to change things in their own culture from that perspective and from their own knowledge. And so it's really important to not try to divert and to not say, oh, sexual violence is something that happens over there. It happens here.
Yeah.
And we need to acknowledge that.
Yeah. Which ties into one of the other suggestions that they offer for ending rape culture, which is to know your history. It is completely nonpartisan to say that America in its founding is connected to rape and sexual violence. When you look at Native American genocide and the enslavement of Black folks, those things are directly related to rape as a weapon of violence, rape as a means of controlling populations, rape as a means of traumatizing entire communities of people. And so one of the best ways that we can challenge rape culture is just by knowing what we are built upon so that we know best how to challenge and fight back against those structures.
I really appreciate that point, Brittany. And it's also something that's not just 250 years ago or whenever it was that our country was founded. This legacy of sexual violence and of violating bodily autonomy is ongoing. I mean, this isn't even recent enough, but one of the examples I know is that I found out recently that it was up through the 1970s that Native women and Black women and disabled women were still being forcibly sterilized without their consent by the medical community as a way of controlling that population, controlling those people and taking away their sexual and bodily autonomy.
Yeah. And I'm sure that there are people who would argue that those things are still happening to this day.
Certainly.
I know that Black, Brown, and Native communities have been used as testing sites for birth control with really horrible side effects. And that's just kind of a common theme if you look at the histories of communities of color where bodies were used as testing sites, not only for birth control, but also for different medical procedures. So we have to then think about who do we consider a victim? Who do we consider rapeable? Because we have a history of looking at people as property or looking at people as test subjects. And when we do that, when we dehumanize folks, then it's even harder to have a conversation about how someone can actually be violated if we're not looking at them as human beings to begin with.
Right. That idea that for Black women especially, they were, when slavery was existed formally, people were viewed as property. So you can't rape property.
Mm-hmm.
And that legacy in terms of media portrayals and imagery of people of color very much continues.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And my last point before we move forward is, and it really ties into the next point about taking an intersectional approach. If you look at the prison industrial complex itself, there are many activists who argue, and I'm inclined to agree, that incarceration in and of itself is a form of sexual violence. You are subject to strip searches. You are subject to your body being touched in ways that you have not consented to, all because you are now considered to be the property of the state. And so we really need to expand what we think of as rape, and we need to expand what we think of as sites of violence. It's not just happening in a dark alley. It's not just happening in someone's bedroom. It's happening in multiple systems as well.
So I think that ties in really well to one of the last points we wanted to look at from this article about approaching this intersectionally, as you were saying, Brittany, and I'm going to read a quote from the article. Think about how a person's income, race, sexuality, and citizenship and immigration status would impact their ability to use the criminal justice system as recourse and come up with strategies that address those challenges. Move the most vulnerable from the margin to the center to develop effective solutions.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to be thinking about the way that racial violence impacts sexual violence, that violence against LGBT folks impacts the way sexual violence occurs.
Mm-hmm.
And the ability, I guess they talk about recourse in this article, thinking about the criminal justice system and whose story will be listened to and believed. And is it even safe to go through the so-called correct route of going to the criminal justice system because of the violence that can occur in that system, both in the prison industrial complex and from policing. So it's really critical to look at that as we're looking for solutions.
Yeah. And I mean, even just going forward and getting a safe exam done or a rape kit done, if you don't have medical professionals that are trauma informed, if you don't have medical staff that are compassionate, then sometimes even despite good intentions, you might re-traumatize someone based on the way that you word something. You might unintentionally say something that is victim blaming. So it's really important to think about all of the different barriers that a victim or survivor might face in order to go through the proper channels, and the fact that they might not even see justice on the other side of that.
Right. Even if someone goes and they get that rape test kit done and they report to the police as you're supposed to do, there are thousands of rape test kits in this country that are untested or have been destroyed without the survivor's consent or permission, without any follow-up work being done because it's past the date for the police to have checked in, or they didn't have time to get to it, or it's just this backlog that's being ignored. So even if you go through all the right steps, that's no guarantee of justice. And of course, we could talk forever about what justice could look like and restorative justice as well. But I don't think we have time for that conversation.
I don't think so either. But that is a great transition into why we believe ending rape culture is central to this work. It's more than creating better policing strategies. It's more than prison reform. It's more than policies on college campuses against drinking. We really have to think about what we can do as a community to hold ourselves accountable. And that's why shifting the conversation from a culture of rape to a culture of consent is so, so, so important. And we could say a lot about this. We're going to try and keep ourselves reined in a little bit. But what do you think is so important about consent, Heidi?
Yes. So a culture of consent, I love that idea because it's about caring for people and respecting them and what they want. And I think sometimes people can be turned off by the idea of consent in a sexual situation because they think, oh, it's not sexy, or it's going to be really awkward, or it's like this robotic, like, can I touch you now? Yes, no. But it's not about that. We're actually practicing consent all the time in our lives, which is an idea you brought up to me, which I really love. It's things like asking, can I pet your dog? Or, oh, hey, you've got something in your hair, can I grab it for you? And we're practicing that all the time, so it only makes sense to extend that into sexual situations and into all parts of our lives because we care about other people's boundaries and making them feel safe and functional and happy in this world.
Yeah. And when we were talking about it before, Heidi, you said something that I just really loved, which is that it's not a checked box. You know, you're not asking someone for their consent so that you can check off this box and then say, all right, here's my safeguard against...
I'm not a rapist tonight.
Yeah.
Check.
Here's my safeguard against someone calling me a rapist. What consent is, I mean, at its basic, consent is permission for how we are going to interact with one another, permission for how I'm going to speak to you, permission for how I'm going to touch you. And it's a conversation. So it's not just something that happens once. It's not something that is encompassed in one or two sentences. It's an ongoing thing. It's, can I touch you here? Oh, I can't. Well, can I touch you here? Let me get some clarification if I don't understand. But then let me also listen to you when you tell me what your wants and needs are.
It's mutual. That's one of the other fundamental things. It's not just one person checking out. I think frequently when we're thinking about this in really gendered terms, it's like a man asking a woman, can we have sex? Yes, check in that term. And then, but it's also totally mutual. Both people need to have consent. Both people need to be enthusiastic. And you need that for all things. People use the phrase all the time, well, it takes two people to make a baby or whatever, but it takes two people to do anything involving two people.
Yes.
You have to have that consent. You have to have that permission for everything from, hey, do you want to get dinner together? Or to, hey, do you want to make out? You have to have that ongoing agreement, because if you don't have that, then one person's rights and autonomy are being violated. And it's also just not an enjoyable experience or a consensual experience for either person.
Yeah. And, you know, Heidi and I talk a lot about how this is a process that we are also engaged in. You know, I'm a big hugger. And something that I had to learn through the work that I do is that hugging someone can actually send someone into a flashback, or hugging someone can cause someone to have a bodily memory of a traumatizing experience. So for me, now it's just a part of my practice to, if I meet someone and we connect, I will say, hey, I'm a hugger. Can I hug you? And that's just, it's become so normal for me. This is a process that we're all engaged in. Really quickly, I just want to mention also that consent is something that you can take away. You know, even if we have slept together before, even if we've slept together yesterday, if we are then engaged in a conversation or a situation where it might be happening now, you still have to ask me again, or there still has to be some sort of confirmation that this can happen. And if I give you that permission, but 10 minutes from now decide I don't want to do this anymore, I can also take it away at any point, even if I'm naked, even if, you know, something is about to go down, I can take that consent away at any point.
Absolutely. There's a really great resource on YouTube called Tia's Consent, this little cartoon video, and it talks about consent in terms of making someone a cup of tea. And so one of the examples is, even if you make someone, you ask them if they want tea and they say yes, and you make the tea, you brew it, you boil the kettle, you add the cream and add the sugar, and by the time it's ready, they've changed their mind. You're not going to go over there and pour the tea on them or force them to drink a cup of tea. Maybe it's annoying that you went to all the trouble to make the cup of tea, but if they don't want to drink the tea, you don't make them drink the tea. You know who else can't drink tea? Unconscious people.
Yes.
Consent is conscious.
Yeah. Consent is, and it's really fitting because we have this relationship with HCC and we know the statistics about sexual assault on college campus. You cannot have consent from someone who is blackout drunk. You cannot have consent from someone who is too inebriated to know where they are, to know who they're with, to know what they're doing. So really, really, really think critically about this idea that if I get someone drunk, I can then interact with them in a sexual way. Because the other thing that consent is, it's informed. This is something that really strikes close to home with me. We hear the term informed consent a lot in medical settings or with research. But when it comes to sexual consent, it's saying that, hey, you're recording us, but I didn't know that you're recording us. I didn't consent to that. Or, hey, you took pictures. Those pictures are for you. They're not for your friends. Or
Thinking about things like birth control, like making sure that you are being honest about if you're on hormonal birth control or not, or that you're going to wear a condom, or if you poked holes in the condom and someone thinks that you're having protected sex, that's not informed consent. Yeah. Or not telling someone if you know that you have a sexually transmitted infection and not telling the other person and having sex with them anyway, that's not the consent that they gave.
Yeah. And what that really speaks to is just expanding our idea of what it means to invite someone into our body. So you can think of that same concept when we're thinking about the medical complex and having informed consent around what birth control options are being presented to me. We really need to just change the conversation about what it means to violate someone's body, because it's so much more than the explicit violence.
And fundamentally, that conversation about consent and creating consent culture is about everyone being informed, everyone making informed choices about their body, and that agreement to care for each other. Mm-hmm. So we're running out of time, but we wanted to leave you all with some ideas about ways that we're caring for each other and for ourselves, because we know this is a lot of information, and Sexual Assault Awareness Month can actually be triggering for some survivors. So, Brittany, how are you taking care of yourself this month?
This month and just the last couple of years has really been a process in understanding my needs, understanding what brings me joy, understanding what brings me pleasure, and then conversely, understanding my boundaries. Because I feel like as I learn to know what my boundaries and limitations are, and as I learn what brings me joy, I can then communicate that to other people. If I know how to please myself, then other folks can then know how to please me, and I can communicate that. What about you?
I love that. For me, it's about self-compassion and self-forgiveness as I'm working to unlearn all of these harmful things that I've internalized and absorbed from growing up in a rape culture, and to be actively practicing asking for consent, even in situations like you suggested with hugging people. Mm-hmm. Find ways to practice that. Find ways to continue to be critical of media, but to be patient with myself and forgive myself when I'm realizing I'm not all the way there yet. And that's going to be a lifelong process.
Yeah. So
I guess that's a good wrap up for us in terms of ways that we're transforming and transformation. Yeah. So thank you so much.
Please consider checking out that article by The Nation, 10 Things We Can Do to End Rape Culture. Check out www.upsettingrapeculture.com. See the work that Force is doing, and please have these conversations amongst yourselves. We're so happy to help with them.
See you next month.